Sherlock Holmes and the Running Noose, written by Donald Thomas and read by John Telfer.
Chapter 1. The Two Failures of Sherlock Holmes. A fragment of biography by John H. Watson, M.D. It is an acknowledged truth that Sherlock Holmes loathed with his whole bohemian soul the reputation of being a schoolbook hero. This thought must have occupied me unconsciously one evening while I was thinking of how I should introduce the cases which follow. Nothing seemed to suit my purpose. Then, as I sat there, I heard in my mind that familiar voice. "Watson, if you are an honest man, you will record this also and set it against my successes." Well, I am no believer in ghosts. Still, this set me wondering where I had heard those words before. A moment later, I had it. More than 30 years had passed since Sherlock Holmes stood by the sunlit windows of Regent Street, shaking his head and uttering these very thoughts. We had been left like a pair of fools watching our quarry vanish from sight in a hansom cab with no means of pursuit. It was the first skirmish in a dark narrative of family misfortune given to the world as the Hound of the Baskervilles. In the next few weeks, as the world knows, we faced the beast with the blazing fangs in the lee of the rain-swept Dartmoor rocks. We tracked John Stapleton of Merripit House to his slow death in the foul ooze of the Grimpen Mire. Yet that sunny moment in Regent Street was recalled by Holmes when he knew, better than any man, how close the end of his own life must be. "If you are an honest man, Watson, you will set these records against my successes." He was sitting on the plain wooden stairs that led up to the Baker Street lumber room, holding out to me several folded legal documents and a notebook. On the cover of the book, in ink now tarnished by damp, he had written simply, "A tabular analysis of hyoscine as a homicidal poison." Long before this, he had tried retirement, and soon wearied of it. The simple life of beekeeping on the Sussex Downs was not for him. Having protested so much that he longed for rural solitude, he returned to Baker Street and took on his old rooms again. The excitement of life as a consulting detective was as necessary to him as the vice of cocaine, and a good deal less injurious. When his hands were idle, the drug mania laid claim to him. I never knew him to have the least need of narcotics when his mind was occupied. The records of many unpublished adventures lay in the lumber room, to which he would retire each day after lunch and remain until the winter afternoon darkened. The tin box, which formerly reposed among the bric-a-brac of his bedroom, had been carried up to this attic level on the orders of Mrs. Clatworthy, his resident nurse. This good woman vowed repeatedly that she would not be answerable if her patient's bedroom were not put into better order. But where the box went, Holmes followed at every opportunity. It contained a mass of papers, most tied in bundles with red ribbon, and each representing a case long concluded. Some dated from a time before I had first met him. Others dealt with matters for which the world is not yet ready, to use the familiar phrase by which he forbade publication. Two or three recorded his failures. One afternoon, he had retired to make a survey of these records. I went up at 5 o'clock to help him down to the sitting room again as the October light faded. He was sitting on the stairs, which declining strength obliged him to use as both chair and desk. His head was bowed over a black-letter legal parchment from one of the bundles on which he had written in his own hand, "The Case of the Naked Bicyclists." He handed it to me without a word, so that I might replace it in the box and turn the key. While I did so, he made his way slowly but unaided down to our rooms.